Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing? Very good. My name is Brett. I am the student pastor here at the Wilmington campus, which means I get the awesome privilege of leading our teams that run middle and high school ministry here, and I love what I do. I enjoy being a part of the student ministries here at the church, and I also am really appreciative of the opportunity I've been given to come and speak down here on this end of the building. So one thing to take care of before we get into the talk tonight, first of all, I wanted to make sure that you see that there is a clear line between my pants and my shirt today. So if you weren't here last week, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but I look like I either had my pants pulled up really high last week or a unitard on. So shirt, pants. All right. So I also want to do this. I've gotten a lot of really encouraging texts and emails from last week, and I just want to say, first of all, thank you for that if you were one of them, but also, it's one thing to come up here and do a really solid one talk. It's another thing to come back and do a second one, so we'll see how that goes. But it's a completely other thing to do what Mike does week after week after week, to come in here and give solid messages and content week after week. So I just want to say thank you to Mike for what he does. And if you could just join me and say thank you, because it's a lot of pressure and it's not easy to do week in and week out. And I think he does an amazing job of it. So the series we're in, a little two-week deal called In One Ear and Out the Other. We've all heard the phrase before. We've all been given advice or discipline or warnings that we've either ignored or forgotten or done nothing about, and the information's just gone in one ear and out the other. So we're familiar with this term of, you know, getting great advice, getting great information, or terrible information. One way or the other, the information goes in one ear and out the other because we never put it into practice, we never did anything with it, or didn't believe that it was really worth listening to in the first place. And the way we kind of approached it last week, and we spent a lot of time on this last week, so not as much this week, was to say that it's kind of like when we were kids and our parents would say stuff and we would totally ignore it and it would go in one ear and out the other. And we like repress those memories until all of a sudden they like come out as we have kids and we say the same things. And we're like, oh my gosh, I sound like my dad. So some of those things, and what was really fun is after every service, I had people come up and share with me the things that their parents shared with them. And it was actually after the 5 o'clock service, and that person's in the room right now. This is the one that they shared with me, and I've been sharing it all weekend long because it's really funny and very true. And actually very apropos to what we're talking about today. This person said, if you're going to be stupid, you better be tough. I was like, that's really good advice, right? You make terrible decisions, at least make sure you're tough and you can handle them. So, and I have two sisters, one in California, one in New Jersey, and I told you last week that I texted both of them to help me remember some of the things my parents said because I obviously had repressed them to a deep, dark place and I couldn't remember them. And I got a bunch of really good they sent me a real lot of good texts. My one sister who still lives in New Jersey is continuing to send me texts. So apparently those affected her much more than any of us because I stopped asking for them and she's still giving them to me. So here are a couple of my mom specifically said. She said no buts about it a lot. I think I said the context of that was she would tell us to do something. We'd say but, and she'd no buts about it. Okay, yes ma'am. Another one, which is really kind of obvious, and I'm not exactly sure why you would repeat that. She said, N-O means no. You're right. It's easy. I know that N-O means no, but I guess she would just get so tired of saying no to us. She would just say, N-O means no. Okay, I won't ask. And so our parents would say things that would go in one ear and out the other. And I said this last week too. I've been speaking with our students for years about the things that we're talking about this week and last week. I've been sharing these things down in Studio 3 and with our students for over a decade. And it never ceases to amaze me that students will come up to me and I'll hear a story they tell me about something that they got in trouble with or something they did years after being a part of our ministry. And I'm like, we talked about that. And down in, do you not remember? And they just let it go in one ear and out the other. And we, for years, used a curriculum curriculum down in our student ministry. It's actually written by, a lot of you guys have probably heard of Andy Stanley, and they wrote a book. He and another guy that we're all fairly familiar with, Stuart Hall, actually wrote a book that for years shaped our curriculum in student ministry. It's called The Seven Checkpoints, seven things that we really want our students to know before they leave high school. And it's full of these really, really good things for students to know. And I decided they're not just good for our students to know. They're good for us as adults. In fact, the one we're talking about today, as I was working on this message, it was just a huge reminder to me of why am I not applying this stuff? It's so simple, and it really has the potential to change the direction of your life if you're able to listen and hear and apply. But you probably have had numerous people around you, coaches, teachers, parents, grandparents, friends, who gave you advice that has gone in one ear and out the other. And to take this to another level, my guess is that we've all probably been given advice, either we've been giving advice, to someone else, either a friend or one of our kids. And as that advice is coming out of our mouths and we hear it in our ears, we realize I don't even listen to my own advice. Like sometimes we're really, really good at giving lessons and giving advice of things that we don't even follow. And it's because sometimes we just, it goes in one ear and out the other. And we know it's good, we know it makes sense, but when it comes to applying it in our lives, sometimes we just miss the mark. The book of Proverbs I mentioned last week, it's a book that was written by King Solomon, and he assembled some of his own sayings and some other popular sayings from the time, and he collected them into a book of Proverbs. And he has a lot that he wrote all throughout that book that really kind of emphasized this idea of listening to advice and not allowing advice to go in one ear and out the other. He said in Proverbs 19, verse 20, "Listen to advice and accept instruction, that you may gain wisdom in the future." That there's some kind of a connection between listening to advice and accepting the instruction, and then in the future, actually gaining wisdom. He said that the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. That so often, those of us, we all will listen, we're so blind to our own blind spots. I guess that's why they're blind spots. But we need other people in our lives to point out where we're going wrong. Kind of a flashback to last week when we talked about. He said that the fool is right in his own eyes. And so many times we're so good at deceiving ourselves and believing something that's simply not true because we don't see our blind spots. And he says that but a wise man listens to advice. We need people in our lives that are going to be able to see things that we simply can't see. But then we need to take it to the next level and actually apply what we're hearing. Proverbs 15, 31 through 33 says, "The ear that listens to life-giving reproof." Now there's a type of reproof or discipline or correction that can actually give life. That's in a positive direction. And the ear that listens to that kind of reproof will dwell among the wise. Whoever ignores instruction despises himself. Now that's pretty strong language. And what Solomon is saying is those of us who don't listen to instruction, who ignore instruction, it's like we hate ourselves. We don't take ourselves seriously enough to listen to what's being said and apply it to our lives. But he who listens to reproof gains intelligence. And then he goes on to say that the fear of the Lord is instruction and wisdom. Somewhere the connection that we have with our maker and our creator and the fear and the humility of submitting underneath him is the beginning of our ability to be wise. And humility comes before honor. And chances are, and I said this last week, that if I gave you time to think back to your greatest regret, that moment in life that you wish you could just get back, or maybe it was a season of life that you just wasted time because of terrible decisions, and that one regret that you wish you could change, my chances are there probably was somebody there giving you advice that had you just put it into practice, you could have been spared years of regret, years of frustration, years of chaos and brokenness. And what we talked about last week and what we're going to talk about today are those type of things. They're that kind of advice that if we start to put them into place, we can avoid future regret. Andy Stanley said this in a book that I was reading in preparation for this talk tonight. He said that your greatest regret could have been avoided had you asked the question that we're going to talk about tonight. That your greatest regret could have been avoided if you had asked the question and acted on the conclusion that you received. So let's kind of review real quick where we were last week. Last week we said this, that your friends will determine the direction and the quality of our lives. And most of us assume that our quality and direction of life is going to be directed and determined by other things outside of our friendships. If we were honest, we'd probably say it has more to do with our status determining the direction and quality of our life, or our income, or the job we have, or the degree we got, or the school we got into, or our looks. All those things we would say probably determine the direction and quality of our life more than our friendships. But what we said last week is not those things. In fact, more so than those things, even though they can direct and determine the quality of our life, our friendships have even more of the potential to do that because we're acceptance magnets. You and I gravitate toward acceptance, and at the same time that we gravitate toward acceptance, we try to avoid rejection. And because we gravitate toward acceptance, acceptance paves the way to influence. Those that have given their acceptance to us have also paved the way for them to be very, very influential in our lives. And because of the influence that our friends and those closest to us, our relationships that are closest to us, that amount of influence that they have in our lives, our friends really do have the potential to determine the direction and quality of our lives. So where we left last week was a challenge for us to determine the direction of the influence. To take an inventory of our lives, to take an inventory of the friends and the people that have the most access to our hearts, and ask the question, what's the direction of the influence? The people who have the most influence over me, is it a positive influence or a negative? And then vice versa, the people that I have a relationship with, that I've accepted, that I've gained influence in their lives, what's the direction of the influence I'm having on them? So that was kind of where we left things off last week. And today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about how it is that we make decisions and how we go about making choices in our lives. Anywhere from what we decide to eat for breakfast or go out to eat for dinner or what we do for entertainment on a Friday night, all the way to the big decisions like, should I marry this person? Where should I go to college? Is this job decision the right place to go? Is this investment the right place? Is this the right house for us? Should we get a mortgage? Should I have a lease? All those big questions that we have, all the decisions that we make, I think there's a way to pursue those kind of decisions that we have to make from the mundane to the really, really big ones in a way that sets us up to have much more, to basically be the people that God has created us to be in our future. Here's the problem when we face questions and we face decisions that we need to make in our lives. Often, when we approach decisions, we are asking the wrong question. More often than not, when faced with a decision, when faced with a choice, we ask this question: is this right? Is what I'm about to do the right thing to do? Is it right for me to make this choice? Is it right for me to make this decision? If I go in this direction, is that the right thing for me to do? In other words, what we're asking is this, another way to ask it, is this wrong? We approach a lot of decisions, we approach a lot of our choices from the standpoint of, is this right or is this wrong? And it's not necessarily a bad way to approach decisions. I just don't think it's the best way. And here's why. We wrongly assume by asking this question, if we ask this question when it comes to decisions, we wrongly assume that if it's not illegal, unethical, or immoral, then it qualifies as a legitimate choice. If there isn't a law against it, if I can't find anything in the Constitution against it, if there isn't a verse in the Bible that it talks about it or gives me advice or what to do about it, then it must be okay. The problem with that line of thinking is this: not every decision that we make is a moral decision. Not every decision that you and I have to make, not every choice that we make, it comes down to a matter of right versus wrong. Especially in our world today, there's so much gray. There's so much in our world that isn't right or wrong. And as an adult, you realize you go from concrete thinking to abstract thinking and realize there's so many nuances to every decision that we make, so many possibilities. So approaching those kind of decisions from a standpoint of right versus wrong is not necessarily the right way to go about it. For example, ice cream. That's why I have these up here. We are going to address these ice cream containers that are up here. Now, in my family, my wife, for your birthday, will make an amazing ice cream cake. She figured out years ago to take like a springform pan and goes into the kitchen and does some sort of wizardry with ice cream and toppings and all kinds of things, and out comes an amazing ice cream cake. It is the best. And when it's your birthday, you get to pick the ice cream, you get to pick the fillings, you get to pick the toppings. It is awesome. And we eat the ice cream cake, and on your birthday, you should get ice cream cake. You should get ice cream or cake, or in my house, you get both in one thing. So it's awesome. Here's the problem with ice cream in my house. It's one thing for it to be on your birthday. My mother-in-law, from time to time, will buy us groceries. And almost inevitably, every week, part of the groceries that she buys us is ice cream. And especially when it's buy two, get three free at Harris Teeter. We stockpile a lot of ice cream in my house. We just got one of those refrigerators that has like the doors up here and then like the pull-out freezer down here. And like there's an entire section, like they have the top drawer and then you slide that back, the whole lower right section is ice cream. We have got a lot of ice cream in my house. And we can't even eat it fast enough, so we'll like give it away. And my mother-in-law operates under the assumption that we give our kids ice cream all the time. What she doesn't realize is that when my kids were really young, we decided that we could not do a dessert for every meal, because then it became a bargaining thing. Well, how much of this do I have to eat? How many bites of this do I have to eat to get dessert? And we just decided we weren't going to negotiate with four-year-olds. And so we decided we don't do dessert during the week. We just do dessert on Friday night, because we eat pizza every Friday night and we know they'll eat that. So that's when we do dessert. And then like, obviously, you know, if they're with grandparents, and we're not like sweet Nazis. We just decided we're just not gonna fight that game during the week. So we stockpile ice cream, which is fine, except for around 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, where they start calling my name from the freezer. Brett, I'm in here, I'm delicious. And inevitably around that time of day, I am faced with the decision of whether or not to grab ice cream. And the terrible decision that I make more often than not is I don't even grab a bowl. I just grab the carton and a spoon. And then 10 minutes later, I realize I've eaten a third of a carton of ice cream. I'm like, that was a terrible decision. But it wasn't a decision of right or wrong. There is nothing wrong with eating ice cream at night. Not every decision, though, is a moral decision. We need to be asking a better question. Here's the other problem with right or wrong. If we can deem that something is not morally wrong, then often we conclude that it's the right decision. We say things like, there's nothing wrong with going to dinner with her. There's nothing wrong with comparing myself to this friend's Instagram post, right? There's nothing wrong with comparing ourselves. There's nothing wrong with going on just one date with him. There's nothing wrong, morally wrong, with spending that much on a lease on a car. There's nothing wrong with a bowl of ice cream after a long day of work. And hey, I exercised today, right? We can rationalize terrible decisions. That's kind of what I do. I'm like, man, I worked out today. I had a rough day at the office. I deserve ice cream. And that's kind of how we go through our decision making. In fact, we are also experts at rationalizing decisions that we know are wrong. We are experts at rationalizing because we have blind spots. Because we don't see our blind spots, we are just experts at rationalizing terrible decisions. We are really, really good at deceiving ourselves. Every kind of addiction begins with self-deception. This won't hurt anybody. I'll only do it once. I haven't had any for a week. I'll be careful. I can handle it. I can quit when I want to. And we are fully aware of the game that we're playing. The fact that we even have to give a reason or excuse should tip us off. And we never have to rationalize good decisions. We never have to stop and rationalize the decision to eat vegetables or to work out or to exercise or to save money or to make sure we spend time with good people or avoid bad company. We always have to rationalize the decisions that we know in our hearts are probably not the right decision, but we rationalize them to the point where we convince ourselves there's nothing wrong with it. And if there's nothing wrong with it, we find freedom. There's actually a story in the Old Testament that's kind of struck me as one of the best examples of kind of pursuing a decision in the totally wrong way. It's way back in Genesis chapter 25. It's the story of Jacob and Esau. If you've grown up in church, you're probably familiar with this story. Jacob and Esau were twins. Esau was the older of the two, and in that culture, they would hand down, as it is still in our culture today, that wealth would be handed down through the family. And in that culture, the birthright meant that the oldest son would always get a double portion. So whatever the inheritance was, the oldest son would always get double what everybody else would get. And there was a spiritual component to the handing off of the birthright. But Esau was born first, Jacob came second. And on this particular day we're going to take a look at, Esau had been out in the field and he was hunting. He had been spending his entire day hunting. Jacob was back home cooking in the kitchen. And that kind of sets the scene. So imagine big manly Esau, manly man hunting, coming home exhausted and hungry. And this is the scene. He says in Genesis 25, verse 29, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom, which actually means red. He actually had red hair too, so he had a thing for red, I guess. And maybe Jacob knew that. But here's the thing, we can't prove whether or not Jacob set this up intentionally or if it just so happened to be this way. Well, knowing what we know of Jacob's character, it's a good chance that he had actually set this up to deceive his brother. And he said this, he goes on to say, Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me? Like, I'm so hungry, I could die right now. And what good is a birthright going to do me if I'm dead? So yeah, sure, take the birthright." Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And in a moment of hangry, it's not a moral decision. It's not a matter of right or wrong. He's still going to get a partial inheritance. But was it wise for a bowl of soup to sell a double portion of inheritance? And therein lies the dilemma that we have when we approach decisions and choices from the aspect of, is this right or is this wrong? So the better question that we should be asking is this. Instead of, is this right or is this wrong, we should be asking, is this wise? Is this wise? And asking that question takes it out of the world of right or wrong and into the world of wisdom. And this question it cuts through all the rationalization. And really, ultimately, if you ask this question, it gets to the heart of any kind of decision, any kind of matter that you're trying to decide on. The Apostle Paul writes a letter in the New Testament. It was a letter to a church that he had established in a city called Ephesus. And he writes them this long letter. We, in modern day, have broken it down into 6 chapters, but it's a letter. He wrote a letter to a church that was kind of struggling with what it meant to walk with God. It's a church that he established. And in this letter, he kind of gives us an idea of what wisdom, or really kind of what it means to ask this question, what's the wise thing to do? He spends the first 3 chapters of the book of Ephesians kind of helping them understand what it means to be a Christian, what it means that we have been made new, what our relationship with God through the birth and death and resurrection of Jesus really means for us, this new life. So he spends 3 chapters kind of describing that newness of life. Then he spends the next couple of chapters going through kind of this long, exhaustive list of things that we as believers really should be doing. What are kind of, how do believers approach all these different things? Like kind of a list of rules and a list of expectations that really were kind of frustrating to look at, if I could be honest. Like if you were to read through Ephesians, the first three chapters, like, yes, this is my new life. This is awesome. Then he goes through this long list of what it means to be a Christian. You're like, no, there's no way I can do this. He ends that list of what are the things that Christians should or shouldn't do by saying this, therefore be imitators of God. Okay, so that's the standard, right? Like, that'd be really frustrating to read this letter and be like, okay, now I have to imitate God? Who could possibly do that? He goes on later on in chapter 5 to put in another therefore. And anytime the word therefore is used, it's usually because the author is trying to say, hey, I want to connect everything I've said already to what I'm about to say. So when Paul says, therefore, he's saying all the stuff I've said about new life in Christ and then this list of do's and don'ts and how we should operate, really all of that leads to, therefore, hey, listen to this. I know you might be a little bit frustrated, but listen to what I'm about to say because I'm about to make this walking with God thing seem a little bit easier. He says this in verse 15 of chapter 5, look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise. He's saying, look, the world is not set up for us to have success in our walks with God. You gotta be careful how you live. You have to choose to pay attention to what you're doing because it's not easy. And Andy Stanley, when he kind of talks about this scripture, uses an illustration that I think is perfect to help us understand what it means to walk wisely. Any of you have dogs that do their business out in the backyard, know what it means to walk carefully and walk wisely when you step into your yard when it's nighttime. You got to pay attention. You can't just blindly go through your backyard or you're going to step in something that you don't want to step in. And the same goes for us when we walk and we go through life. And Paul's saying you got to pay attention. You can't blindly walk through life assuming that everything's going to be fine because it may not be. So he says, pay attention. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time because the days are evil. Just like now and thousands of years ago, the world in which we live is not designed for us to be able to walk through without paying attention. Our culture is just not set up for us to be able to walk successfully as believers in Christ unless we're paying attention. It was the same thing in Paul's day to this church that he was writing to in the city of Ephesus. Part of the religious culture was to do things that were super egregious to what it meant to walk with God, totally contradictory to what it meant to be a Christian. And some of the people in the church were already sliding back into those old habits, into those old ways. And he said, stop, be careful, don't be unwise, don't be a fool. Pay attention because your culture is not set up for you to have success. So even more so, you have to pay attention. He goes on to say, therefore, don't be foolish. Don't be unwise. But understand what the will of the Lord is, which seems like a super intimidating thing. It's almost as intimidating as be imitators of God. How is it that I'm just supposed to automatically understand God's will? And what he really means in that statement is own up and face up to what you already know in your heart is true. When he says to understand what the will of the Lord is, really what he's saying is you already know what is right. Face up to it. Own up to it and do that. So more often than not, we know the right thing to do. And what Paul is encouraging us in our culture is to step up and face up to what you know in your heart is to be right and to be true and do that. So what does it look like to ask this question? I mean, it makes sense, right, to ask this question, is this wise or is this not wise versus right or wrong? How do we practically go about doing that? I think the best way to do that is to ask this question in three different ways. The first way I think to think about this idea of wisdom or asking the question, is this wise, is to say this, in light of my past, what's the wise thing to do? In light of my past, what is the wise decision? In light of my emotional and relational wirings, and all of us have those. We've all been wired a certain way. We've all been wired emotionally in the way that we've been designed. In light of the way that we've been wired relationally, in light of our tendencies and genetics. Genetics plays a big role in this. It's important for us to look back, look to our past, and say, where have I gotten in hot water in the past? How have I been wired? Where have I made mistakes in the past? And in light of my past, now what is the right thing to do? On days where I know I've had a hard day, the question is not, is it right to eat ice cream? Is it wise to eat ice cream? Because in the past, I've just said, yeah, I'm going to eat it. And that's a really simple example, but there are so many ways that we can learn from our past just to look back and say, where have I made mistakes and where can I prevent those things from happening and it, based on wisdom. I read a book in preparation for this. It's called The Little Red Book of Wisdom. It's by a guy named Mark DeMoss. And he has a chapter in here that's entitled, The Best Defense is a Good Defense. And he's talking about what it means to have wisdom in a particular area. And he opens up with an illustration of a CEO of an organization all of us would be familiar with if I were to say it. And this CEO, in the way that he was wired, in the way that he was raised, in a very affectionate family, in a family that did lots of hugging and back patting, and in his relational style was very much a relational person. He wanted to get to know people and have a close relationship, very gregarious, the center of attention. That's just kind of the way he was wired and the upbringing that he had. Well, 30 years after starting the company and being the CEO, he got himself in a little bit of hot water because of a couple of misunderstandings with some members of his staff in the opposite gender. They just didn't understand where he was coming from. They didn't quite understand. They couldn't read him, and they read him incorrectly. And he kind of had to walk through some allegations that they found out were not true, that were misunderstandings, but nevertheless kind of were a red flag for him. 3 or 4 years later, after that happened, he was doing what was customary for him in his company and his organization, which was to share a ride to the airport. He would do this for years. They were 2 hours away from the airport. And on this particular day, he shows up, and it happens to be a female coworker who rides to the airport with him, and then shortly afterwards accuses him again of inappropriate behavior. He didn't learn from his mistake. Turns out, again, it was wrong, but nothing ever happened, but he never learned from the first, and he lost his role in the company as a result. We got to ask the question, in light of my past, in the light of the way that I'm wired, in light of everything that I've gone through in my life, what is the wise thing to do? Another way to ask the question, in light of my present, what is the wise thing to do? Both in the moment and in this season. So many times, how many times do we make mistakes when we make decisions in the moment? And that was Esau's problem. It was a moment of weakness. It was a moment of hunger. We should never go to the grocery store when we're hungry because you make terrible decisions. You've heard that before. But, you know, we have to pay attention to our emotional state. Where am I right now in this moment? Is this the right time to make this decision? I remember years ago being in a van with students, and there were a couple of girls having a conversation and didn't realize I was listening. And one of them was asking the other, hey, would you let your boyfriend do this? And the answer back was, I don't know, maybe. If I had a fight with my mom, yes, for sure. Knowing our current state of mind, our current emotional state, is huge in making decisions. Also, we need to figure out, in light of my present in this season, it's not just a momentary thing. There's seasons of life when things that were unwise in a previous season now become wise, and vice versa. Things that were wise in a particular season of life now are unwise. For example, in our family, I have 3 kids, 8, 10, and 12. My wife was a teacher before we started having kids, so she taught for 5 years. And when we had our daughter, we made the decision for our family that in this season of life, She was going to stay home and be with our kids. It was a really big struggle to give up the really big teacher salary, but we did it. We just decided, hey, in this season for us, it's not a matter of right or wrong. What's wise for us is just for us to stay home with our kids. Now my kids are old enough, and the chances of them getting into too much trouble without us around has decreased. So my wife is back at work. So what was unwise, we felt like, for our family back then is now wise for my wife to be back at work teaching preschool, and she loves it. But there were seasons where we had to make different decisions based on what our family life looked like. When your kids are young, it's a season. You got to figure out what is the right thing for me to do when your kids are older. When you're single, what is the wise thing for me to do when I'm single versus when now when I'm married or when I'm dating? Seasons of life call for us to make for different types of wisdom. Question, in a season of difficulty relationally with a spouse, what's the right thing to do? If you're in a season of struggle with a spouse, the wise thing to do changes. It's not wrong to get on the computer at night. Is it wise? It's not wrong to have an extended lunch with a coworker, but is it wise? And it's all seasonally based. So in light of my present, what is the wise thing to do? As a small group leader or someone that others are looking to as an example of someone with a walk with God, what's the wise thing for me to do? If you're in a position of leadership for that season, what is the wise thing for you to do? And it's maybe totally different than when you're not in one of those positions. The last way to ask the question, if you could probably guess, is in light of my future hopes and dreams, what's wise? Every single one of us has a picture in our minds of our futures and what we want them to be. And if we don't ask what is wise, small decisions can train wreck the futures we're imagining. So many times, people train wreck amazing futures by one small decision. So we have to ask ourselves, in light of my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for me to do now? It happened to Esau. He lost an entire future of a double birthright because of a decision that he made, ignoring his future for a bowl of soup. All of us have a future and a future hopes and dreams. We have a picture of what we want it to be like. Let's not wreck it by asking, is this right or wrong? Let's ask the question, in light of that future, what's wise? And here's how I want to wrap this up. Kind of in the same way I did last week. See, all of this is really practical advice. You know, looking at our friendships and deciding how, you know, who we're having relationships with and how they influence us, that's a very practical thing. Understanding the difference between right and wrong and wise, very practical. In fact, even if you don't have a relationship with God, this is all stuff that if you started to apply it, could probably make a huge difference in your life. But those of us who do have a relationship with God actually have an ace up our sleeve. We actually have an advantage when it comes to making decisions. When we're faced with difficult choices and we don't know where to go and we don't know what to do, James writes in James, the very beginning of his book, 1 verse 5, says this, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Those of us who have a walk with God, who have a relationship with our Creator, the one who designed your future, those of us who have a relationship with him through Jesus have the advantage of being able to ask for wisdom. And he promises, if you lack wisdom, ask of me and I'm going to give it to you. What would it look like for you to start asking the question, is it wise, as opposed to is this right or wrong? I believe that if we as a body of believers started asking that question, we would begin to realize the future that God has for us and not miss out on the opportunities and the way that God wants to use us in our futures. And we will avoid massive amounts of regret if we begin to ask the question, what is the wise thing to do? Don't let it go in one ear and out the other. Figure out ways this week to ask that question and put it into practice. I mean, I'm amazed as I was preparing this message just how much I need to help myself, like really remind myself about this. I'm in the same boat as you guys, and I need to ask this question as well. So let's not let it go in one out the year, one in one year, out the other. I'm glad I don't have to say that again anymore. So, all right, let's pray, guys. Lord, you're so good. You love us. You created us. You've given us a hope and a future in you. You've designed us to be a particular way. You've created us to be exactly the way that we are. And you love us, and you give us access to your wisdom. You can see our future. You know the plans you have for us. So I pray that we will have the courage to ask you, to seek you when making decisions. I pray that all of us will begin to examine the choices and decisions that we have to make on a daily basis, from not from the question of is it right or wrong, but from the question of is this wise? And I'm going to thank you in advance for what you're going to do in us and through us as we begin to realize what it is you have planned for us. And I pray this in your name. Amen.